Chapter 4 Tactics Defensive and Offensive Postures Winning with Ease, Method, and Discipline.
Sun Tzu said, "The good fighters of old first put themselves beyond the possibility of defeat, and then waited for an opportunity of defeating the enemy." To secure ourselves against defeat lies in our own hands, but the opportunity of defeating the enemy is provided by the enemy himself. Thus, the good fighter is able to secure himself against defeat, but cannot make certain of defeating the enemy. Hence the saying, "One may know how to conquer without being able to do it." Security against defeat implies defensive tactics. Ability to defeat the enemy means taking the offensive. Standing on the defensive indicates insufficient strength. Attacking indicates a superabundance of strength. The general who is skilled in defense hides in the most secret recesses of the earth. He who is skilled in attack flashes forth from the topmost heights of heaven like a thunderbolt, against which there is not time to prepare. Thus, on the one hand, we have ability to protect ourselves. On the other, a victory that is complete. To see victory only when it is within sight of the common herd is not the height of excellence. Nor is it the height of excellence if you fight and conquer and the whole empire says, "Well done." To lift a hair is no sign of great strength. To see the sun and the moon is no sign of sharp sight. To hear the noise of thunder is no sign of a quick ear. What the ancients called a clever fighter is one who not only wins, but excels in winning with ease. His victories bring him neither reputation for wisdom nor credit for courage. He wins his battle by making no mistakes. Making no mistakes is what establishes the certainty of victory, for it means conquering an enemy that is already defeated. Hence, the skillful fighter puts himself into a position that makes defeat impossible, and does not miss the moment for defeating the enemy. Thus it is that in war, the victorious strategist only seeks battle after the victory has been won, whereas he who is destined to defeat fights and afterward looks for victory. The consummate leader cultivates the force and strictly adheres to method and discipline. Thus it is in his power to control success. In respect of military method, we have 1. Measurement, 2. Estimation of quantity, 3. Calculation, 4. Balancing of chances, 5. Victory. Measurement owes its existence to earth, estimation of quantity to measurement, calculation to estimation of quantity, balancing of chances to calculation, and victory to balancing of chances. A victorious army opposed to a routed one is as a pound's weight placed in the scale against a single grain. The onrush of a conquering force is like the bursting of pent-up waters into a chasm 1,000 fathoms deep. This is all there is to be said about tactics.
Dumu said, "True excellence is to plan secretly, to move surreptitiously, to foil the enemy's intentions and thwart his schemes, so that at last the day may be won without shedding a drop of blood. Inasmuch as such victories are gained over circumstances that have not yet come to light, the world at large knows nothing of them, and the clever fighter wins no reputation for wisdom. Inasmuch as the hostile state submits before there has been any bloodshed, he receives no credit for courage."
Zheng Yu added, "One who seeks to conquer by sheer strength, clever though he may be at winning pitched battles, is also liable on occasion to be vanquished. Whereas he who can look into the future and discern conditions that are not yet manifest will never make a blunder, and therefore invariably win."
And Cao Gong remarked, "The thing is, to see the plant before it has germinated, to foresee the event before the action has begun.
Li Chuan told this story. Han Xin, when about to attack a vastly superior army, said to his officers, "Gentlemen, we are going to annihilate the enemy and shall meet again at dinner." The officers hardly took his words seriously and gave a very dubious assent. But Han Xin had already worked out in his mind the details of a clever stratagem whereby, as he foresaw it, he was able to capture the city and inflict a crushing defeat on his adversary.
Referring to measurement and its corollaries, Dumu concluded, "The question of relative strength having been settled, we can bring the varied resources of cunning into play."
Chapter 5. Energy and Power. Direct and indirect maneuvers, the power of decision, combined energy.
Sun Tzu said, "The control of a large force is the same in principle as the control of a few men. It is merely a question of dividing up their numbers. Fighting with a large army under your command is in no way different from fighting with a small one. It is merely a question of instituting signs and signals. To ensure that your whole host may withstand the brunt of the enemy's attack and remain unshaken, use both direct and indirect maneuvers. That the impact of your army may be like a grindstone dashed against an egg, this is affected by the science of weak points and strong, the hollow and the solid. In all fighting, the direct method may be used for joining battle, but indirect methods will be needed in order to secure victory. Indirect tactics, efficiently applied, are as inexhaustible as heaven and earth, unending as the flow of rivers and streams. Like the sun and the moon, they end but to begin anew. Like the four seasons, they pass away but to return once more. There are not more than five musical notes, yet the combinations of these five give rise to more melodies than can ever be heard. There are not more than five primary colors, yet in combination they produce more hues than can ever be seen. There are not more than five cardinal tastes, sour, acrid, salt, sweet, bitter, yet combinations of them yield more flavors than can ever be tasted. In battle, there are not more than two methods of attack, the direct and the indirect. Yet these two in combination give rise to an endless series of maneuvers. The direct and the indirect lead on to each other in turn. It is like moving in a circle. You never come to an end. Who can exhaust the possibilities of their combination? The onset of troops is like the rush of a torrent that will even roll stones along in its course. The power of decision is like the well-timed swoop of a falcon that enables it to strike and destroy its victim. Therefore, the good fighter will be terrible in his onset and prompt in his decisions. Energy may be likened to the bending of a crossbow. Decision may be likened to the releasing of the trigger. Amid the turmoil and tumult of battle, there may be seeming disorder, and yet no real disorder at all. Amid confusion and chaos, your array may be without head or tail, yet it will be proof against defeat. Simulated disorder postulates perfect discipline. Simulated fear postulates courage. Simulated weakness postulates strength. Hiding order beneath the cloak of disorder is simply a question of subdivision. Concealing courage under a show of timidity presupposes a fund of latent energy. Masking strength with weakness is to be affected by tactical dispositions. Thus, one who is skillful at keeping the enemy on the move maintains deceitful appearances according to which the enemy will act. He sacrifices something that the enemy may snatch at. By holding out baits, he keeps him on the march. Then with a body of picked men, he lies in wait for him. The clever combatant looks to the effect of combined energy and does not require too much from individuals. Hence, his ability to pick out the right men and to utilize combined energy. When he utilizes combined energy, his fighting men become, as it were, like rolling logs or stones. For it is the nature of a log or stone to remain motionless on level ground and to move when on a slope. It is also in the nature of a log or a stone, if square, to come to a standstill, but if round-shaped, to go rolling down. Thus, the energy developed by good fighting men is as the momentum of a round stone rolled down a mountain thousands of feet in height. So much on the subject of energy.
Du Mu reminds us of Han Xin's famous reply to the first Han emperor, who once said to him, "How large an army do you think I could lead?" "Not more than 100,000 men, Your Majesty." "And you?" asked the emperor. "Oh," he answered, "the more the better."
On direct and indirect, it was said, in war, to march straight ahead is zheng. Turning movements, on the other hand, are qi.
Emperor Tai Zung said, "A qi, indirect maneuver, may be zheng, direct, if we make the enemy look upon it as zheng. Then our real attack will be qi, and vice versa. The whole secret lies in confusing the enemy so that he cannot fathom our real intent."
Lionel Giles observes, "There is emphasis on proper timing here, and restraint, like that which keeps the falcon from swooping on its quarry until the right moment. There is also the matter of judging when the right moment has arrived."
Wang Qi referred to the falcon's mode of attack, short and sharp, and said, "This is how the psychological moment should be seized in war."
Du Mu said, "If you wish to feign confusion in order to lure the enemy on, you must first have perfect discipline. If you wish to display timidity in order to entrap the enemy, you must first have extreme courage. If you wish to parade your weakness in order to make the enemy overconfident, you must have exceeding strength."
Zhang Yu related this anecdote of Emperor Cao Zi. Wishing to crush the Xiongnu, he sent out spies to report on their condition. But the Xiongnu, forewarned, carefully concealed all their able-bodied men and well-fed horses, and only allowed infirm soldiers and emaciated cattle to be seen. The result was that the spies, one and all, recommended the emperor to deliver his attack. Lu Jing alone opposed them, saying, "When two countries go to war, they are naturally inclined to make an ostentatious display of their strength. Yet our spies have seen nothing but old age and infirmity. This is surely some ruse on the part of the enemy, and it would be unwise for us to attack." The emperor, however, disregarding this advice, fell into the trap and found himself surrounded.
Du Mu pointed out the converse. If one's force happens to be superior to the enemy's, weakness may be simulated in order to lure him on. But if inferior, he must be led to believe that we are strong in order that he may keep off. In fact, all the enemy's movements should be determined by the signs that we choose to give him.
Dumu relates this anecdote. Sun Pin and Tian Ji, leaders of the Qi state, were sent against the general Pang Juan of Wei. Sun Pin said, "Our side has a reputation for cowardice, and therefore our adversary despises us. Let us turn this circumstance to our advantage." Accordingly, when the army had crossed the border into Wei territory, he gave orders to show 100,000 fires on the first night, 50,000 on the next, and the night after only 20,000. Pang Juan pursued them hotly, saying to himself, "I knew these men were cowards. Their numbers have already fallen away by more than half." In his retreat, Sun Pin came to a narrow defile, which he calculated that his pursuers would reach after dark. Here he had a tree stripped of its bark and inscribed upon it the words, "Under this tree shall Pang Juan die." Then, as night began to fall, he placed a strong body of archers in ambush nearby, with orders to shoot the moment they saw a light. Later on, Pang Juan arrived at the spot and, noticing the tree, struck a light in order to read what was written on it. His body was immediately riddled by a volley of arrows, and his whole army thrown into confusion.
On matters of combined energy, Dumu stated, "The general first of all considers the power of his army in bulk. Afterward, he takes individual talent into account and uses each man according to his capabilities. He does not demand perfection from the untalented."
Chapter 6. Weak Points and Strong. Speed and Distance. Secrecy and Concealment. The Infinite Variety of Circumstances.
Sun Tzu said, "Whoever is first in the field and awaits the coming of the enemy will be fresh for the fight. Whoever is second in the field and has to hasten to battle will arrive exhausted. Therefore, the clever combatant imposes his will on the enemy, but does not allow the enemy's will to be imposed on him. By holding out advantages to him, enticing him with a bait, he can cause the enemy to approach of his own accord, or, by inflicting damage, striking at some important point which the enemy will have to defend, he can make it impossible for the enemy to draw near. If the enemy is taking his ease, he can harass him. If the enemy is well supplied with food, he can starve him out. If the enemy is quietly encamped, he can force him to move. Appear at points that the enemy must hasten to defend. March swiftly to places where you are not expected. An army may march great distances without distress if it marches through country where the enemy is not. You can be sure of succeeding in your attacks if you only attack places that are undefended. You can ensure the safety of your defense if you only hold positions that cannot be attacked. That general is skillful in attack whose opponent does not know what to defend, and he is skillful in defense whose opponent does not know what to attack. O divine art of subtlety and secrecy! Through you we learn to be invisible and unheard, and hence we can hold the enemy's fate in our hands. You may advance and be absolutely irresistible if you make for the enemy's weak points. You may retire and be safe from pursuit if your movements are more rapid than those of the enemy. If we wish to fight, the enemy can be forced to an engagement even if he is sheltered behind a high rampart in a deep ditch. All we need to do is attack some other place that he will be obliged to relieve. If we do not wish to fight, even though the battle lines are drawn, we can prevent the enemy from engaging us. All we need to do is to throw something odd and unaccountable in his way to distract him. By discovering the enemy's dispositions and remaining invisible ourselves, we can keep our forces concentrated while the enemy's must be divided. We can form a single united body while the enemy must split up into fractions. Hence, there will be a whole
pitted against separate parts of a whole, which means that we shall be many to the enemy's few. And if we are able thus to attack an inferior force with a superior one, our opponents will be in dire straits. The spot where we intend to fight must not be made known, for then the enemy will have to prepare against a possible attack at several different points, and his forces being thus distributed in many directions, the numbers we shall have to face at any given point will be proportionately few. For should the enemy strengthen his front lines, he will weaken his rear. Should he strengthen his rear, he will weaken the front. Should he strengthen his left, he will weaken his right. Should he strengthen his right, he will weaken his left. If he sends reinforcements everywhere, he will everywhere be weak. Numerical weakness comes from having to prepare against possible attacks. Numerical strength comes from compelling our adversary to make these preparations against us. Knowing the place and the time of the coming battle, we may concentrate from the greatest distances in order to fight. But if neither time nor place be known, then the left wing will be impotent to succor the right equally impotent to succor the left, the front lines unable to relieve the rear, or the rear to support the front. How much more so if the farthest portions of the army are 100 li apart, and even the nearest are separated by several li? Though the soldiers of the enemy exceed our own in number, this shall not win them victory. I say then that victory can be achieved. Though the enemy be stronger in numbers, we may prevent him from fighting. Scheme so as to discover his plans and the likelihood of their success. Rouse him and learn the principle of his activity or inactivity. Force him to reveal himself so as to find out his vulnerable spot. Carefully compare the opposing army with your own, so that you may know where strength is superabundant and where it is deficient. In making tactical dispositions, the highest pitch you can attain is to conceal them. Conceal your dispositions, and you will be safe from the prying of the subtlest spies and from the machinations of the wisest brains. How victory may be produced for them out of the enemy's own tactics, that is what the multitude cannot comprehend. All men can see the individual tactics whereby I conquer, but none can see the strategy out of which total victory is evolved. Do not repeat the tactics which have gained you one victory, but let your methods be regulated by the infinite variety of circumstances. Military tactics are like water, for water in its natural course runs away from high places and hastens downward. So in war, the way of the force is to avoid what is strong and to strike at what is weak. Water shapes its course according to the nature of the ground over which it flows. The soldier works out his victory in relation to the foe whom he is facing. Therefore, just as water retains no constant shape, so in warfare, there are no constant conditions. He who can modify his tactics in relation to his opponent, and thereby succeed in winning, may be called a heaven-born captain. The five elements, water, fire, wood, metal, earth, are not always equally predominant. The four seasons make way for each other in turn. There are short days and long. The moon has its periods of waning and waxing.
Zhang Yu said, "He who is skilled in attack flashes forth from the topmost heights of heaven, making it impossible for the enemy to guard against him. This being so, the places that he shall attack are precisely those that the enemy cannot defend. He who is skilled in defense hides in the most secret recesses of the earth, making it impossible for the enemy to estimate his whereabouts. This being so, the places that he shall hold are precisely those that the enemy cannot attack. If the enemy's dispositions are visible, we can make for him in one body, whereas our own dispositions being kept secret, the enemy will be obliged to divide his forces in order to guard against attack from every quarter.
Dumu said, "If the enemy is the invading party, we can cut his line of communications and occupy the roads by which he will have to return. If we are the invaders, we may direct our attack against the sovereign himself."
He also told this anecdote about distracting the enemy. Zhuge Liang, when occupying Yangping City and about to be attacked by Sun the First, suddenly dropped his flags, stopped the beating of the drums, and flung open the city gates, showing only a few men engaged in sweeping and sprinkling the ground. This unexpected proceeding had the intended effect, for Sun the First, suspecting an ambush, actually drew off his army and retreated.
Chapter 7. Maneuvering, the Art of Handling Large Masses of Men.
Sun Tzu said, "In war, the general receives his commands from the sovereign. Having collected an army and concentrated his forces, he must blend and harmonize the different elements thereof before pitching his camp. After that comes tactical maneuvering. The difficulty of tactical maneuvering consists in turning the devious into the direct, and misfortune into gain. Thus, to take a long and circuitous route after enticing the enemy out of the way, and those starting after him, to contrive to reach the goal before him, shows knowledge of the artifice of deviation. Maneuvering with an army is advantageous. Maneuvering with an undisciplined multitude is most dangerous. If you set a fully equipped army to march in order to snatch an advantage, the chances are that you will be too late. On the other hand, to detach a flying column for the purpose involves the sacrifice of its baggage and stores. Thus, if you order your men to pack up their equipment and make forced marches without halting day or night, covering double the usual distance at a stretch, and doing 100 li in order to wrest an advantage, the leaders of your 3 divisions will fall into the hands of the enemy. The stronger men will be in front, the jaded ones will fall behind, and on this plan, only 1/10 of your army will reach its destination. If you march 50 li in order to outmaneuver the enemy, you will lose the leader of your 1st division, and only half your force will reach the goal. If you march 30 li with the same objective, 2/3 of your army will arrive. We may take it then that an army without its baggage train is lost. Without provisions, it is lost. Without bases of supply, it is lost. We cannot enter into alliances until we are acquainted with the designs of our neighbors. We are not fit to lead an army on the march unless we are familiar with the face of the country, its mountains and forests, its pitfalls and precipices, its marshes and swamps. We shall be unable to turn natural advantages to account unless we make use of local guides. In war, practice dissimulation, and you will succeed. Move only if there is a real advantage to be gained. Whether to concentrate or to divide your troops must be decided by circumstances. Let your speed be that of the wind, your compactness that of the forest. In raiding and plundering, be like fire. In immovability, be like a mountain. Let your plans be dark and impenetrable as night, and when you move, fall like a thunderbolt. When you plunder a countryside, let the spoil be divided among your men. When you capture new territory, cut it up into allotments for the benefit of the soldiery. Ponder and deliberate before you make a move. He will conquer who has learned the artifice of deviation. Such is the art of maneuvering. The ancient book of army management says, "On the field of battle, the spoken word does not carry far enough. hence the institution of gongs and drums. Nor can ordinary objects be seen clearly enough, hence the institution of banners and flags. Gongs and drums, banners and flags, these are means whereby the ears and eyes of the host may be focused on one particular point. The host, thus forming a single, united body, it is impossible either for the brave to advance alone or for the cowardly to retreat alone. This is the art of handling large masses of men. In night fighting, then, make much use of signal fires and drums, and in fighting by day, of flags and banners, as a means of influencing the ears and eyes of your army. A whole army may be robbed of its spirit. A commander-in-chief may be robbed of his presence of mind. Now, a soldier's spirit is keenest in the morning. By noonday, it has begun to flag, and in the evening, his mind is bent only on returning to camp. A clever general, therefore, avoids an enemy when its spirit is keen, but attacks when it is sluggish and inclined to return. This is the art of studying moods. Disciplined and calm, to await the appearance of disorder and hubbub among the enemy, this is the art of retaining self-possession. To be near the goal while the enemy is still far from it, to wait at ease while the enemy is toiling and struggling, to be well fed while the enemy is famished, this is the art of conserving one's strength. To refrain from intercepting an enemy whose banners are in perfect order, to refrain from attacking an army drawn up in calm and confident array, this is the art of studying circumstances. It is a military axiom not to advance uphill against the enemy, nor to oppose him when he comes downhill. Do not pursue an enemy who simulates flight. Do not attack soldiers whose temper is keen. Do not swallow a bait offered by the enemy. Do not interfere with an army that is returning home. When you surround an army, leave an outlet free. Do not press a desperate foe too hard. Such is the art of warfare.
Woodza said, "Without harmony in the state, no military expedition can be undertaken. Without harmony in the army, no battle array can be formed."
Sun Tzu himself was quoted as saying, "Those who are waging war should get rid of all domestic troubles before proceeding to attack the external foe."
Du Mu cited the famous march of Zhao Shu to relieve the town of Ouyu, which was closely besieged by a Qin army. The king of Zhao first consulted Lian Po on the advisability of attempting a relief, but the latter thought the distance too great and the intervening country too rugged and difficult. His Majesty then turned to Zhao Shu, who fully admitted the hazardous nature of the march, but finally said, "We shall be like two rats fighting in a hole, and the pluckier one will win." So he left the capital with his army, but had only gone a distance of 30 li when he stopped and began throwing up entrenchments. For 28 days he continued strengthening his fortifications and took care that spies should carry the intelligence to the enemy. The Qin general was overjoyed to learn of Zhao's tardiness, but the spies had no sooner departed than Zhao began a forced march lasting for 2 days and one night, and arrived on the scene of action with such astonishing rapidity that he was able to occupy a commanding position before the enemy had got wind of his movements.
Cao Gong pointed out, "Don't march 100 li to gain a tactical advantage. Maneuvers of this sort should be confined to short distances."
Stonewall Jackson said, "The hardships of forced marches are often more painful than the dangers of battle."
Lionel Giles noted the following regarding General Jackson: "It was only when he intended a surprise or when a rapid retreat was imperative that he sacrificed everything to speed."
Chen Hao quoted the saying, "Birds and beasts, when brought to bay, will use their claws and teeth."
Zhang Yu said, "If your adversary has burnt his boats and destroyed his cooking pots and is ready to stake all on the issue of a battle, he must not be pushed to extremities."
Hu Shi told a story about this. Fu Yancheng, a general, was surrounded by a vastly superior barbarian army. The country was bare and desert-like, and his little force was soon in dire straits for want of water. The wells they bored ran dry, and the men were reduced to squeezing lumps of mud and sucking out the moisture. Their ranks thinned rapidly, until at last Fu Yancheng exclaimed, "We are desperate men. Far better to die for our country than to go with fettered hands into captivity." A strong gale happened to be blowing from the northeast and darkening the air with dense clouds of sandy dust. An officer named Li Shouzheng saw an opportunity and said, "They are many and we are few, but in the midst of this sandstorm our numbers will not be discernible. Victory will go to the strenuous fighter, and the wind will be our best ally." Accordingly, Fu Yancheng made a sudden and wholly unexpected onslaught with his cavalry, routed the barbarians, and succeeded in breaking through to safety.